From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The war in Syria gets most of the headlines, but there's another battleground about 2,000 miles south, where thousands of people have been killed in the past year and 2.5 million forced from their homes. We're talking today about Yemen, the site of an all-out civil war since March of 2015. It's a complex conflict, but there are two major factions. The first is a Sunni Muslim force based in the south and loyal to Yemen's president, Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi. This pro-government group has been backed by airstrikes by a Saudi Arabia-led coalition. The second are the Houthis. This is a mainly Shia rebel force that has seized control of a large part of the country over the past year and forced President Hadi to flee. The Houthis are supported by Iran. They're also allied with a former president named Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was forced to step down back in 2011 during the Arab Spring. Meanwhile, the Islamic State has gained its own foothold in Yemen, and Al-Qaeda's local branch, already one of the terror group's most dangerous affiliates, has been able to expand its presence significantly. The biggest losers in all this have been ordinary people. 80% of the country's 28 million people need humanitarian aid. Many are cut off from help by the fighting. We've got a lot to discuss today, so I'll bring in our first guest. Scott Shane is a national security reporter at the New York Times. He's also the author of Operation Troy, a book about the American-born leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Anwar al-Awlaki. He was killed in a drone strike by the U.S. in Yemen in 2011. Scott, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me on.
If you could just remind our listeners, how significant was al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen? How significant is it now in terms of a threat to the U.S. and globally?
Well, there had been a long sort of jihadist tradition in Yemen, but al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this branch, actually officially started in the beginning of 2009 and sort of drew in mostly Yemeni and Saudi militants. It was at a time when the core al-Qaeda organization in Pakistan was coming under intense pressure from drone strikes, American drone strikes. And so the affiliates were beginning to become more important. And this particular affiliate, AQAP, as it's known, took on particular importance in part because it began to look at what they called, what al-Qaeda called the far enemy, which is to say the United States, as opposed to the near enemy, which would be the Yemeni government and the Saudi monarchy.
And remind us of some of the attacks that they had attempted. There was an effort to plant a bomb in someone's underwear on a Northwest Airlines jet in 2009. And even last year, I think the Charlie Hebdo attackers said at least that they were inspired by this affiliate.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for the most part, these attacks aimed at the U.S. failed. But there was the underwear bomber who actually got aboard, a young Nigerian got aboard a plane, and he tried to explode his underwear bomb above Detroit. It fizzled, and, you know, he's now serving life in prison. No one was hurt but him. There was also in 2010 an attempt to they put two bombs in printer cartridges aboard two cargo aircraft addressed to Chicago. But a tip from Saudi intelligence allowed them to get those bombs off the planes before they blew up. And they're believed to be continuing to attempt such things. But since the killing in 2011 of Anwar al-Awlaki and also the sort of chaos and civil war in Yemen, it appears that there's a little less active focus on the United States as a target.
And you mentioned al-Awlaki. He was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Yemen back in 2011. What do we know about the drone war in Yemen? How frequent has the U.S. been launching attacks there? Is it still doing so today?
Well, the armed drone was introduced after 9/11 in Pakistan. The strikes were sharply escalated in the last 6 months of the Bush presidency in 2008, and Obama, to the surprise of some people, actually escalated the drone war in Pakistan, and then finally began to strike in Yemen in late 2009, first using other weapons, jets and cruise missiles, but then eventually started using drones quite aggressively in Yemen against AQAP. And that has continued, sort of off and on to the present day. So Yemen is, after Pakistan, by far the location of the country with the most U.S. strikes.
Now, in your book, Objective Troy, you write about Anwar al-Awlaki, who was born in the United States, was a U.S. citizen, eventually moved to Yemen, became one of the important leaders of AQAP, and he was killed. But it sounds like he's still a very influential figure even after his death. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the remarkable thing about this guy is that he lived, his entire work, essentially before video cameras and microphones. So if you go on YouTube today, 4 years after he was killed, and you put his name into the search engine, you come up with 60-something thousand videos. Some of them are news reports about his death, but most of them are his work, ranging from his early mainstream lectures about the life of the Prophet Muhammad all the way up to his very straightforward calls for all Muslims to join the fight against America. And, it's all there, available at a click. And many of the Western terrorism cases of recent years, including the Boston Marathon bombing, for example, even the San Bernardino killings in December, where 14 people were shot down by that young couple, when they looked into it, the FBI has found, a very strong influence of Anwar al-Awlaki. His work can kind of take you from mainstream Islam to out and out embrace of violence and, sort of war on America. And he continues to do that from beyond the grave.
And with just a few seconds left, Scott, what was your sense? You traveled to Yemen as part of researching this book, reporting on al-Qaeda. What was your sense as to how effective the U.S. drone campaign in Yemen has been? Awlaki has been killed, some other Qaeda operatives. Is it undermining the extremist threat to the United States, to other countries?
It's as in other places, it's sort of a question of tactics and strategy. It's certainly true that the U.S. has killed a lot of leaders of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, including Nasser al-Wuhayshi, a former secretary to Osama bin Laden, who led the group. But, again, that's taken place against a background of chaos and civil war in Yemen that has hugely strengthened al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which has actually been able to seize some territory and control it. So it seems certainly at the strategic level, the drone war has not helped a great deal, even if it has perhaps disrupted the group's ability to plan attacks against the U.S.
Scott Shane, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me.
I'll remind our listeners, I'm Jason McClure. You're listening to Global Journalist. This week, a look at the hidden war in Yemen and how it's tearing the country apart and threatening stability in an area where much of the world's oil is either produced or shipped. We're joined now by two people who have kept a close eye on the region. From Cairo, Adam Barron. He's a visiting fellow for the European Council on Foreign Relations. And from Geneva, Nawal Al-Maghafi, a reporter and filmmaker who's made documentaries on Yemen for the BBC and other news outlets. Nawal Al-Maghafi, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you for having me.
You were just in Yemen reporting relatively recently. Tell us just generally about the overall humanitarian economic situation there now.
I've been covering Yemen for around 5 years now, and the situation in Yemen, as you all know, it was already the poorest country in the Middle East. The humanitarian situation was already pretty bad, but now it's to a whole different scale. Because of this war, the Saudi-led coalition has imposed a blockade around the country. And in a nation which relies on imports for 90% of its food and medical aid and fuel, this is having a devastating effect. 21.2 million people out of the 24 million people, that's 82% of the population, requires some form of humanitarian aid. And this is a third increase since this war began. 2.3 million people are now displaced. That's four times the number of that it was before this war began. And more than every second person in Yemen is now struggling to find the next meal that they're going to have tomorrow. It's a man-made human catastrophe. It's really, really devastating.
Adam Barron, remind our listeners just a little bit about the two major sides to this conflict. The Houthi rebels, these pro-government forces backed by Saudi Arabia, what are their goals? What are they hoping to achieve in this war?
I mean, on the larger level, we're talking about a war between two sides, two principal sides, and those are the Houthis, which are at this point effectively trying to defend themselves against the Saudi onslaught and continue their dominance over the state, and Yemen's legitimate internationally recognized government, which is trying to reclaim its position in Sana'a and re-extend its control over the country. That being said, while it's often referred to as a single conflict, what we're really looking at in Yemen is a number of conflicts. You have the Houthis' ally of convenience, Ali Abdullah Saleh, Yemen's former president, who is basically at this point attempting to reclaim and reposition and defend his sort of position of control over much of the country. In the south, you have the fighters and the backers of the so-called Southern Movement, which is trying to reclaim the independence of the south, which was lost in 1990 when North and South Yemen were unified. You have groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, which are trying to carve out their own areas of control. You have people in areas like the central province of Taiz or the tribal province of Madib that are attempting to push back against the central state's dominance over the country. So effectively, you have a number of different conflicts. On the one hand, you have this idea of an internationally recognized government backed by Saudi Arabia attempting to push back against those who executed a coup, who themselves are trying to defend their recently gotten gains. But at the same time, you have a country that has long been in turmoil, a Yemen that is a mosaic of different conflicts. And in some sense, as we've seen this war develop, this mosaic of different conflicts, this array of different fault lines, has continued to fuel deepening violence while making it all the more difficult to bring this conflict to an end.
And now, while Adam Barron paints kind of a complex picture of the conflict there, I understand that you were just in Geneva covering peace talks there between the Houthis, between the Saudis and the pro-government forces. Tell us just a little bit about those and why those talks broke down.
So Adam painted a really good picture of how the politics works inside of Yemen. But then there's also another arena to this war, which is the international arena. So you're talking about, you know, people involved like, of course, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states and Iran. And, you know, there's more of a regional dilemma. And what I saw...
And Iran is supporting the Houthis, is that correct?
Well, to a certain extent, it's never really been proven just how much they're supporting the Houthis, but they definitely have some sort of influence. And so when you put all these different Yemeni factions around the table, and you don't have the kind of, you know, the bigger picture, the, you know, you don't have Iran and Saudi Arabia all around the same table, then it's not going to be very, it's not going to result into anything major. And at the same time, I really don't think any of the sides that came to the peace talks had any intention of resolving this conflict. It was more theater in front of the international world that they're actually attempting to. But there's so many different things that are involved in this conflict. And there's so many people that are making so much out of this conflict that they don't have any pure intentions to resolve it. Both sides believe that a military victory is possible, even though, you know, all the factors show that it's completely impossible. And so while they still believe that a military victory is possible, they're never going to resolve this through diplomatic negotiations.
Adam Barron, Nawal spoke briefly about the role of Iran in this conflict. They are often associated with the Houthis. The conflict is sometimes described as sort of another part of a proxy war in the Middle East between Shia Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia. Tell us what your view on that is.
I mean, there's no question that there's a strong affinity between Iran and the Houthis and Hezbollah as well. Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has given a number of very fiery addresses condemning Saudi Arabia for this war and expressing his support for the Houthis. Indeed, you've just had these alleged videos leaked to Saudi news alleging to show Hezbollah forces advising the Houthis in their battles on the Saudi border. Regardless of the veracity of these claims, there's no question that you do have a strong affinity. There's no question that Iran is providing a great degree of political and media support to the Houthis. That being said, it's crucial to remember that the Houthis are at their essence an indigenously Yemeni group pulling off of local Yemeni factors, and that this entire conflict is at its roots an internal Yemeni conflict, an internal Yemeni battle for power. That being said, there are, of course, regional implications. It's not shocking that Saudi Arabia would be very loath to accept a significant presence of the Houthi rebels just south of their border, that they would be very reluctant to, and unwilling indeed, to allow a group that is aligned with their largest rival in the region, and that has expressed very staunchly anti-Saudi rhetoric, to effectively have a base to potentially launch attacks against Saudi Arabia. So while this is at its essence of any conflict, there are these regional implications.
And Nawal, if you want to pick up on that, I also wanted to ask you specifically about the role of the United States and the United Kingdom in this conflict, because they are often referred to as being supportive of the Saudi alliance. Why is the U.S., why are Britain involved in this conflict at all?
Firstly, I'll just pick up on what Adam said. Is that another thing that's really affecting this is that it's become a question of pride. I mean, neither side is willing to step down without a complete military victory. And they have, you know, they just don't really care about how the toll it's taking on the civilians on the ground. As for the United States and America, you know, you've seen, it's been all over the news the last couple of days, just the increase in arms sales. The UK and the US are the biggest arms sellers to Saudi Arabia. And so they're making a lot of money out of this war. But what's really shocking to me is from what we heard in your previous interview about AQAP, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, is that at first the United States paid such a major role in Yemen in counterterrorism. And in this war, it's doing the complete opposite, because when you have such a power vacuum, and right now so many things are affected are at a standstill in Yemen, like businesses and universities and schools. And so lots of people are left with nothing to do. You have these terrorist organizations fueling, really making use of this at the moment and recruiting. And they're really the ones thriving in this conflict.
But how does that, like, what are the U.S.'s interests there? Why are we there to begin with? I can't believe that it's purely to make money on selling bombs, on selling arms.
And put quite simply, it's to support their allies. And their allies are Saudi Arabia and the Gulf.
Well, Adam Baron, let me have you pick up on that then. What leverage do you see that countries outside the region have over the main actors in this conflict? Iran, Saudi Arabia, the Houthis, the forces on the ground in Yemen?
I'll be completely honest, it's quite limited. As we've seen, when you speak of the Houthis and Saleh, the United States, the European Union, other Western actors, the UN has very limited, if any, leverage on the Houthis and Saleh. If you look over the past few years, whether before this conflict started or even in the beginning of the conflict, they've used the bulk of their carrots and sticks. So the question is, what leverage can be used? It's very difficult to say. These are groups that have never had, in the case of the Houthis, have never had strong any sort of relations with the West. And then in the case of Saleh,
in fact, the Houthis' motto is death to America, death to Israel. Is that correct?
Exactly. So that's not a group you're really going to get a lot of Western leverage over. When it comes to the Saudis, it's important to remember that this war started right around the time, right before the closing of the Iran nuclear deal. And the Iran nuclear deal is something that has left many of America's traditional allies in the Gulf, including Saudi Arabia and the Emirates particularly, very on edge. So now I would say you have a position where the United States' leverage over Saudi Arabia is quite low. Indeed, if you speak to Saudis and if you see the way this war has been portrayed in a lot of the Saudi media, this has been saying they painted it as something to take pride in, and the fact that you have Saudi Arabia in a coalition that it has created and it is leading, undertaking this military endeavor effectively on its own. It's, of course, being cast as the decisive storm, the name of the first operation. And that's something that you really have to look into, the extent that this is being seen as a sign of Saudi Arabia's willingness to take charge on its own end, even if it is, of course, very much dependent on European, American, British arms at this point.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week we're diving into the ongoing civil war in Yemen and how people inside the country are being affected. Our guest this week from Cairo, Adam Baron, a visiting fellow for the European Council on Foreign Relations, and from Geneva, Nawal El-Magafi, a reporter and filmmaker who's made multiple documentaries on Yemen for the BBC and other news outlets. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @GlobalJourn. Nawal al-Magafi, you were just in Yemen relatively recently. Tell us about your sense of what it's like to be there as a reporter. And I understand you were there with some Westerners. How are Westerners viewed by the Yemeni population right now?
I mean, before, when I used to take people with me to Yemen, I was always very excited. Westerners and people from, you know, that haven't been to Yemen, when they visit, they're always very excited. It's such a nice and different place to go to. And Yemen is really a place where time has stood still. There's so much to see. And Yemenis are also the most hospitable and welcoming people to Westerners or to foreigners in Yemen. But I think this time it was a lot more difficult. Not only were we worried of the security situation and because of the airstrikes and the shelling and, you know, there's just so much going on, but also there's such a rise in anti-US and UK sentiment because of the conflict that's going on. Yemenis are aware of where these, you know, who's selling the arms to Saudi Arabia. And there's just a lot of anger. So it was definitely different. For myself as a journalist, I think being originally Yemeni always helps. Being a woman usually helps because it means I can cover up and I can keep a low profile and just, you know, completely blend into the environment that I'm in.
Adam, if you would, talk to us just a little bit about the role of the Islamic State in Yemen. They have set off a number of car bombs there, including one recently that killed the governor of Aden, some larger bombs targeted at Shia funerals and other gatherings. How significant a force are they? And is this Saudi coalition, is that who they're going after?
I guess there's a number of elements to this. First, at this point, it remains unclear to what extent the Islamic State has a presence on the ground. It does exist. It does appear to be growing, particularly taking recruits away from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen's traditional jihadi group. Although there is an element, according to many, that its size is being exaggerated, and indeed that many other political forces are taking advantage of IS to engage in their own score settling, to, you know, take care of their own assassinations under the name of IS, that it has sort of various elements that it is being used as a political tool by some. Until this point, from my understanding, is that the Saudi-led coalition has not yet launched a single airstrike targeting the Yemeni branch of the Islamic State group or the fighters of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. There's talk that this could potentially be changing, but at this point, there has not yet been a single strike from them, a single confirmed strike from them targeting either group. That being said, U.S. drone strikes have continued.
And Nawal al-Magafi, we have seen that al-Qaeda has been able to expand its foothold in Yemen, at least the territory that it controls there. What do we know about sort of the nature of al-Qaeda's conflict there right now? Are they sort of a domestic Yemeni fighting force now, or are they still a group that's kind of focused on international terror?
I mean, from what we've been seeing lately is that most of their attacks have been domestic in Yemen, and it's mainly against the Houthis. They've been targeting IS or AQAP, you know, both have been targeting Houthi, like not Zaydi mosques, which are, you know, mainly have Houthis inside them. As for recruitment, obviously, in any place where there is a complete power vacuum, it just creates fertile ground for them to recruit. But right now, especially because the, you know, people have no income coming in, people have lost their jobs. 50% of university students that were enrolled in university last year can't afford to go this year. And so when you have this body that's you know, giving people jobs and giving them salaries, obviously they're going to join them. And so al-Qaeda is recruiting at a very scary scale.
And Adam Barron, if you could, just walk us back a little bit. Now, back in 2011, during the Arab Spring, the former president, Saleh, was ousted from power, and this seemed like there was going to be a moment, you know, across the Arab world and in Yemen where there could be some positive political change. That didn't happen. Can you tell us just briefly what went off the rails?
I mean, we're dealing with a number of factors. I think what it comes down to at its essence is that the traditional powers in Yemen, and this is both Ali Abdullah Saleh and traditional tribal and military forces that eventually broke with him, particularly over the course of 2011, these traditional powers remained in place. So you had a change that may have been psychological and certainly appeared to be taking place, but all of the pieces, even if they were sort of taken apart, they were just sort of moved around. So you really didn't have this dismantlement of the Ali Abdullah Saleh network. You didn't have the dismantlement of other traditional networks that were originally allied with Saleh but broke with him in 2011. So I think the real reason this conflict has continued at this point is that it didn't end in 2011. Effectively, the internationally brokered power transfer deal of the end in 2011 was akin to setting the button on pause. And what we've seen is that the conflict has resumed with a greater ferocity than it's been seen over the past 2 or 3 years.
And Nawal, if you could, tell us just a little bit about what you see happening in the future here. You and Adam both, I think, have painted a fairly depressing picture of this conflict where both sides seem really dug in large part out of pride. What do you foresee happening over the next year or two? What can outsiders do to help?
Unfortunately, I don't see anything positive. I think, you know, there's been a stalemate on the ground for months now. Nothing has really changed. No one's making any major advances, and they're still at it. They're still fighting viciously on the ground. I think without them sitting around the table and without pressure from the outside on both sides to reach a political settlement, we're just going to continue to see more bloodshed. We're going to watch the humanitarian catastrophe worsen. And it's just a bleak future for Yemen and the Yemeni people.
And Adam Barron, with just about 30 seconds left, tell us why this conflict has gotten relatively little media attention.
I think it comes down to the fact that Yemen has always been viewed through as a peripheral country. Even within the Arab world, it's a country that's often forgotten. So while it's deeply tragic when you look at the history of the coverage of Yemen, I guess it's not surprising that it's not getting too much coverage at this point. That being said, unfortunately, I feel like there will come a time, sooner rather than later, in which the world will be asking, why did we not pay attention to Yemen? And we'll look back and wonder why there was not coverage of this before things continue to deteriorate even further.
That's going to do it for this edition of Global Journalist. Many thanks to Scott Shane, Adam Barron, and Nawal Al-Magafi for joining us. Before we go, a quick note. This weekend at the University of Missouri, students from around the country and around the world are gathering for the annual Universities Fighting World Hunger Summit. The students are working to solve the ongoing problem of food insecurity and world hunger. Since starting more than a decade ago, this program has grown to more than 300 campuses around the globe. Joining the conference this year are author Roger Turow, former World Food Program Director Catherine Bertini, and Julie Borlaug of the Norman Borlaug Institute for International Agriculture. I'll remind our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about this, go to ufwh.org. That's going to be it for this edition of Global Journalist. Our executive producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Javila Roskoskit, Dorothy Sidovic, Aaron Pelish, Joe Carey, and Iulia Alieva. Travis McMillan of RJI is our studio director. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. Until next week, for all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure.